Sean ignored the outstretched hand, and China glanced at it, and then lowered it to his side.
So we part, Colonel. Me to my little war, and who knows, perhaps one day a country of my own. You to the tender embraces of your very rich, very beautiful young American.
His smile had a sly and foxy slant to it.
I wish you joy, and I am sure you do the same for me.
He turned back to his map, leaving Sean for an instant nonplussed and taken off balance. It was incomplete. It couldn't end like this. Sean knew there was more to come. But General China began dictating orders to one of his officers in Portuguese, leaving Sean standing uncertainly at the door of the bunker. Sean waited a few moments longer, and then turned abruptly and ducked out through the entrance. Only after he was gone, China lifted his head and smiled after him, a gloating little smile, which, if Sean had seen it, would have answered his question. Alfonso's men had worked quickly. The litter was a fiberglass stretcher, one of those lightweight body-moulded types used by mountain rescue teams. Nonetheless, it would still require four men to carry it over rough ground, and they had a long, hard path to the border.
"Less than 100 kilometres, and not that hard," Sean reassured himself.
2 days, if we push it."
Claudia greeted him with relief.
"Job seems stronger. He was conscious, asking for you. He said something about a hill, Hill 31?
Sean flickered a smile.
"That's where we met. He's wandering a little. Help me to get him onto the stretcher."
Between them, they lifted Job gently and settled him onto the fiberglass stretcher. Sean rigged the drip set on a wire frame above his head and tucked looted grey woolen blankets around him.
"Matatu," he said as he stood up,
"take us home."
And he gestured to the first team of stretcher bearers to take their positions. It was less than 2 hours since sunrise, but they seemed to have lived an entire lifetime in that short period. Sean thought as he glanced back at the hilltop lager. Streamers of smoke drifted from its crest, and the last column of General China's porters was disappearing into the forest below it, all heavily laden with booty. The distant sounds of battle had finally dwindled into silence. The half-hearted Frelimo counterattack had long ago fizzled out, and China was withdrawing his forces into the bad ground below the Pungwe River. As Sean watched, the captured Hind helicopter rose slowly out of its emplacement and hung above the hill on its glistening rotor. Then abruptly it dipped towards them, the sound of its engine crescendoed, and suddenly Sean was staring into the multiple mouths of the Gatling cannon in its nose. As it raced towards him, he recognized China's face behind the armored glass canopy. He was perched in the flight engineer's seat at the controls of the 12.7mm cannon. Sean saw the barrels of the cannon traverse slightly, coming on to aim. The Hind was only 50 feet above them, so close he could see China's teeth flash in his dark face as he smiled. Their little column had not reached the edge of the forest. There was no cover, no protection from the blast of that terrible weapon, and instinctively Sean reached out and drew Claudia to him, trying to shield her with his own body. Above them, General China lifted his right hand in an ironic salute, and the Hind banked steeply away into the northwest, dwindled swiftly to a speck, and was gone. They all stared after it silently, seized by a sense of anticlimax, until Sean broke the spell.
"Let's go, brethren."
And once again the stretcher-bearer started forward at an easy jog-trot, singing very softly one of the ancient marching songs. Scouting ahead of them, Matatu came across a few scattered parties of Frelimo assault troops, but they were all in headlong retreat from the river wilderness. After the loss of their air support, the Frelimo offensive seemed to have collapsed completely, and the situation was fluid and confused. Although they were forced to detour further northwards than Sean had planned, Matatu steered them out of contact with any Frelimo and the stretcher-bearers were rotated regularly, so they made swift progress. At nightfall, they stopped to eat and rest. Alfonso made the scheduled radio contact with RENAMO headquarters and gave them a position report. He received only a laconic acknowledgement without change of orders. They feasted on tinned goods looted from the Russian stores and smoked the perfumed Balkan tobacco in yellow cigarette paper with hollow cardboard filters. Job was conscious again and complained in a husky whisper.
There's a lion gnawing on my shoulder.
Sean injected an ampoule of morphia into his drip set, and it eased him so that he was even able to eat a few mouthfuls of the bland-tasting tinned meat. However, his thirst was far greater than his hunger, and Sean held his head and helped him get down two full mugs of the surprisingly good Russian coffee. Sean and Claudia sat beside the litter and waited for the moon to rise.
"We are going in through the Honda Valley again," Sean told Job. "Once we get you to St. Mary's Mission, you'll be fine. One of the Catholic fathers is a doctor, and I'll be able to send a message to my brother Gary in Johannesburg. I'll ask him to send the company jet to Umtali, and we'll fly you into Johannesburg General Hospital before you know what's hit you, mate. There you get the best medical attention in the world."
When the moon rose, they went on, and it was almost midnight before Sean called a halt for the night. He made a mattress of cut grass beside Job's litter, and as Claudia drifted off to sleep in his arms, he whispered to her,
"Tomorrow night I'll give you a hot bath and put you between clean sheets."
"Promise?" she sighed.
"Cross my heart."
From deeply ingrained habit, he woke an hour before first light and went to rouse the sentries for dawn standby. Alfonso threw aside his blanket, stood up and fell in beside him. When they'd made the sentry round, they paused on the edge of the camp, and Alfonso offered him one of the Russian cigarettes. They smoked from cupped hands, shielding the glow of burning tobacco.
"What you told me about South Africa, is it true?" Alfonso asked unexpectedly.
"What did I tell you?"
"That men, even black men, eat meat every day?"
Sean smiled in the darkness, amused by Alfonso's concept of paradise, a place where a man could eat meat every day.
"Sometimes they get so sick of eating beef," he teased, "that they try chicken and lamb just for a change."
Alfonso shook his head. That was beyond belief. No African could ever tire of beef.
"How much does a black man earn in South Africa?" he demanded.
"About 500 rand a month, if he's an ordinary unskilled labourer. But there are many black millionaires."
500 rand was far more than a man earned in Mozambique in a year, even if he were lucky enough to find employment. A million was a figure beyond Alfonso's powers of imagination.
500?
He shook his head in wonder.
"And paid in rands? Not paper escudos or Zimbabwe dollars?" he demanded earnestly.
"Rands," Sean confirmed.
Compared to other currencies in Africa, the rand was as good as a gold sovereign.
"And there are things in the stores, things for a man to buy with his rands?"
Alfonso demanded suspiciously. It was difficult for him to visualize shelves laden with goods for sale, other than a few pathetic bottles of locally produced carbonated soft drinks and packets of cheap cigarettes.
"Whatever you want," Sean assured him. "Soap and sugar, cooking oil and maize meal."
Half-forgotten luxuries in Alfonso's mind.
"As much as I want?" he asked. "No rationing?"
"As much as you can pay for," Sean assured him. "And when your belly is full, you can buy shoes and suits and ties, transistor radios and dark glasses."
"A bicycle?"
Alfonso demanded eagerly.
"Only the very lowest men ride bicycles," Sean grinned, enjoying himself. "The others have their own motor cars."
"Black men own their own motor cars?"
Alfonso thought about that for a long time.
"Would there be work for a man like me?" he asked with a diffidence that was completely out of character.
"You?" Sean pretended to consider it, and Alfonso waited apprehensively for his judgment.
"You?" Sean repeated.
"My brother owns a gold mine. You could be a supervisor on his mine within a year, a shift boss in 2 years. I could get you a job the same day you arrived at the mine."
"How much does a supervisor earn?"
"1,000, 2,000, Sean assured him, and Alfonso was stunned. His Renamo pay was the equivalent of a rand a day, paid in Mozambique escudos.
"I would like to be a boss supervisor," he murmured thoughtfully.
"Better than a Renamo sergeant?" Sean teased,
and Alfonso chortled derisively.
"Of course, in South Africa you would not have the vote," Sean ribbed him. "Only pale faces get to vote."
"Vote? What is a vote?" Alfonso demanded, and then answered himself. "I don't have a vote in Mozambique. They don't have the vote in Zambia or Zimbabwe or Angola or Tanzania. Nobody has the vote in Africa, except perhaps once in a man's life, to elect a president for life and a one-party government."
He shook his head and snorted.
"Vote? You can't eat a vote. You can't dress in a vote or ride to work on it. For 2,000 rand a month and a full belly, you can have my vote."
"Any time you come to South Africa, you come and see me."
Sean stretched and looked at the sky. He could see the trees against it. Dawn was only a short time away. He crushed out the butt of the cigarette and began to get to his feet.
"There is something I must tell you," Alfonso whispered.
And his altered tone caught Sean's full attention.
"Yes?"
He squatted down again and leaned closer to the Shangani. Alfonso cleared his throat in embarrassment.
"We have travelled a long road together," he murmured.
"A long, hard road," Sean agreed. "But the end is in sight. This time tomorrow..."
He did not have to go on, and Alfonso did not reply immediately.
"We have fought side by side," Alfonso said at last.
"Like lions," Sean confirmed.
"I have called you Baba and Unkosi Kakulu."
"You have honoured me thus," Sean said formally, "and I have called you friend."
Alfonso nodded in the darkness.
"I cannot let you cross the Zimbabwe border," he said with sudden decisiveness, and Sean rocked back on his heels.
"Tell me why not?"
"You remember Cuthbert?" Alfonso asked, and it took Sean a moment to place the name.
"Cuthbert? You mean the one from the Grand Reef Air Base, the one who helped us on the raid?"
It all seemed so long ago. "General China's nephew," Alfonso nodded. "That is the one I speak of."
"Sammy Davis Jr.," Sean smiled. "The cool, laid-back cat. I remember him well."
"General China spoke to him on the radio this very morning from the Lager of the Henshaw after our victory. I was in the outer room of the bunker. I heard everything he said."
Sean felt a cold wind blow down his spine, and the hair at the base of his skull prickled.
"What did China tell him?" he asked, dreading the reply.
"He ordered Cuthbert to let the Zimbabwean army know that it was you who led the raid on Grand Reef and stole the Indeki full of missiles. He told Cuthbert to tell them that you would be crossing back into Zimbabwe through the Honda Valley at St. Mary's Mission, and they must wait for you there.